Welcome once again to the Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey, Communications Director. Jay Abraham, have to ask you briefly about revering yourself. When in your career did you understand the importance of that, and explain what it is?
Well, Marty, it's a philosophy that I think is probably the springboard or the real lever that gets most people to jump explosively up to a higher and then maybe a higher level of performance. It's based on the fact that most people complain about how little respect they get, how little people value what they do, how little people appreciate them. But if they don't value themselves and they don't revere themselves and they don't start the beginnings of any relationship by positioning themselves in a way where their customer or their prospect or their employer or their employee has the utmost and profound appreciation for them, if they don't continue that reverence process all along, they cannot expect any different outcome. I learned one of the greatest lessons, and as a gift to the subscribers to The Edge, we're going to include it actually on this tape. We're going to splice it in as a permanent reference for everybody. But when I was in Australia, I was impacted profoundly by a man. I wish I could tell you I taught him. He actually taught me. The man is a dentist, and in Australia, the average dentist, they work 60 hours to make approximately $60,000 Australian, about $45,000. They work their hearts out, and they don't make a lot of money. This dentist works 23 hours and makes approximately $400,000, and he does it by changing the rules he plays the game of dentistry by. Most dentists basically take everybody, and it's a very predictable and a very medicinal, no pun intended, type of environment. He changed the rules. He used to operate at conventional dentistry, and about three-quarters of his patients he loathed. They weren't pleasant. They didn't pay their bills. They didn't come with frequency. They only came when they had problems. They were late for their appointments. They were everything that made him... He didn't enjoy their company. They were like nonplus as far as human beings, and he just didn't enjoy them in the context of rendering a service. He purged them. It took an incredible leap of faith. He purged everybody but the people he thoroughly enjoyed, and he enjoyed them on one of a couple of criteria. They were either extremely delightful people to have as patients. They paid their bills. They were there on time. They were preventatively oriented. And he decided those were the exact kind of people he wanted the entirety of his practice predicated on. So he started a process where in the beginning, from the very beginning, he changed the rules of the game he played. When anybody came as a new patient to his practice, he sat down with them and spent approximately 15 minutes interviewing them and being interviewed by them. He got rid of his waiting room in the standard context and gutted it and turned it into five salons, basically booths like a restaurant. He got a part-time chef to cook for him and bake breads and rolls and muffins in the morning so that it was a really nice smelling and a nice context of the environment. When anyone came in, he would sit down with a new patient. He would sit down for approximately 15 minutes. He'd start off by overviewing what he thought they should expect out of their dentist. And that expectation was predicated on a lot of different factors. Number one, they should expect their dentist to schedule appointments and live by them. Number two, they should expect their dentist to worry about them at a higher level than they would worry about themselves. Number three, they should expect their dentist to perform services at such a level of professionalism and artistry and craftsmanship that the work was superlative and endured. Number five, they should expect their dentist to no way, shape, or form render any pain to them and be gentle and respectful. Number six, they should expect their dentist to worry about them as if they were a member of the family. He went on with a litany of things. And he basically said, he drew the picture, he focused what they should expect. The next thing he did was turn the table. So here's what I, as your dentist, should expect from you. Number one, I should expect if you're going to be my patient, you revere and treasure the importance of your teeth and your oral health and your oral hygiene, and you respect the fact that we're in this together to keep your teeth solid and enduring and in your mouth and healthy for your whole life. Number two, I expect you to schedule with me and honor those appointments on a regular basis to take good preventative maintenance. Number three, when you make an appointment, I expect you to show up. Number four, if you come to that appointment, I expect you to be there on time, never be late. If I render the service that you expected of me, I expect you to tender the payment right there on the spot. I don't want to send you a bill. I don't want to have to worry about you. Number 5, I want to be your friend and I want you to be my friend. I want you to care about me at the level I care about you, and I don't want our relationship just to be professional. I want us to care about each other in a deep and fraternal level. I want to know about your family. I want to know about your life. I want to know about your hopes, your dreams. I don't just want to come and think in the limitations of your mouth. Number 6, if you are satisfied and I perform the way you expect in the first session we have together, I expect between then and a month from there you to refer to me at very least 3 patients of similar quality and value system as you, because that's the you habitate with the kind of people I want as clients or patients. Consequently, you are the best source. And when I say refer to me, I don't want you to give me the names. You must call them up. You must extol my virtues. You must basically compel them to call my office and get on the waiting list, because we do have a waiting list. And if you fail to do that, I'll have to charge you more, because it means I have to expend more effort and money in marketing my practice. So he changed the whole rules, Marty.
Wow. Now, should we listen to that now?
Yes, we should listen to it right now. And I should tell you prior to that, that at all the expensive training programs I do, the 5, the 10, the 15, the 25, I play that, and I play it 4 times. I have sent it out to people in all kinds of businesses who don't realize the value of referrals. Referrals are the highest level of acknowledgement of the value you have in people's eyes, and it's a process I do particularly strong in the real estate business. I've changed people's businesses from being non-referral to being 80% referral, and in the process, reduced their marketing cost and effort by as much as 90 to 100% to zero. I have improved the average unit of sale and the profitability by as much as 4 times. The philosophy of listening to this tape is that you have to revere yourself and you have to think transactionally past the limitations of what you normally do generically. You've got to look at the impact and the influence what you do has on somebody's lives so you can appreciate the powerful relevancy of your importance, your reverence, your value to them. It's not just I sell, in the dentist case, I sell dentistry. It's the fact that if you come to me, I will keep your teeth in your mouth healthy for the rest of your life. You will not have to wear dentures. You will not be anything but maximum attractive. If there's a problem, I will keep you cosmetically beautiful or handsome or distinguished and proud and confident, because you'll always be proud to open your mouth because you'll know you look great. You'll always feel great. If there is a problem, I will take care of it in a way that will never come back to haunt you. It'll be done right, and it will always be done the same way I would do it for my own family. And if you look at whatever it is you do, the listener in business, and you try to transcend the limitations of viewing yourself as a generic commodity and expand to viewing yourself as a creator of transformational value for people, and you ask yourself this question: what are the impact or the influences my service or product properly rendered or used has on somebody's life? In the real estate industry, which I can give you a good example, I ask realtors to talk about what the influence has been. They basically, most of them have such a low self-image, they just look at themselves as salespeople or agents selling or listing or buying or selling or representing property. And I said, that's not what you do. You make it possible for someone's entire life to be changed. In the buying capacity, you help somebody move to a higher level of lifestyle in a neighborhood that gives them more joy. You gave them a chance to create for themselves an incredible appreciating asset that will maybe pay for their retirement. You've enabled their family and their children to live and flourish in an environment that's more stimulating, where they have a higher probability probably of success, of happiness. You've done so many things. And maybe in the process, you've helped them negotiate an acquisition on that house that was $50,000 or $70,000 or $100,000 less than they may have been asking and that those people were initially willing to pay. That $100,000 is enough to pay the moving expenses, pay for their children's college, save them probably $1,000 a month for 30 years in mortgage payments. All of those factors are issues that you have to revere if you're going to revere yourself and the impact of what you do and its influence on somebody's lives. And that really applies to anybody selling anything tangibly, intangibly, product or service. Until and unless you revere the implication of what you do on somebody's life, and not just the generic basis, but the transactional, the transformational, and the implicational aspects, you can't begin to respect and hold yourself in high enough esteem. If all you see you do is being a merchant of things, that doesn't really give you a lot of confidence in yourself. If you see the things you sell change people's lives and the implications of how they change people's lives, that starts getting really exciting. Does that make sense to you, Marty? I asked this question. I want to make sure if I'm not clear that you challenge me and you ask for illustration, but I think that that's the greatest gift of summary I can give somebody, and they should listen to this tape at least 4 or 5 times. In it, the man tells the posture, he tells the philosophy, he tells what happened in his own life, and he gives a really neat, simple, little strategic philosophy that you can apply to anything you do. And if you listen to it, this single tape, which is all of maybe 8 minutes, has impacted more profoundly more people than you'll ever imagine. And I'd like to hope that it will do the same for the people listening to it here. I recommend, commend, and urge everybody listening to listen to it multiples of one time, at least 4 or 5. It has made incalculable, positive, and profitable, and intangible impacts on almost everybody at my expensive programs I've ever, ever, ever shared it with. It was the result of me getting to know somebody well enough that he revealed to me a transactional philosophy that has enabled him to earn whatever 60, if 400,000 is to 60, almost 6.5 times the average income of his industry, working approximately 2/3 less time and having total control of his destiny, operating in an environment of pure pleasure and joy with people he thoroughly enjoys being with, and having a glorious time in the process, where he looks more forward to Monday mornings than he does Friday. And that's something that I think very few people listening to this tape could say about their situation right now.
Well, let's listen.
Okay.
In my business, I only take people by referral. And the way that I started doing that was initially by asking people for referral, and that was fairly scary to say to somebody, would you ask one of
your... It was awkward too, wasn't it?
It's awkward, it's scary, it's intimidating, and it makes you feel a little small somehow. And then somewhere, and I'm sure somebody gave me the idea, but I can't remember who, but thank you, whoever gave it to me. Somebody said, or some little part of my brain said, what about if you tell people that they've got to refer people to you?
And that was, what if you make that a condition of doing business with you, is what you're saying?
Yeah. When someone becomes a client of mine, I sit them down and I say, hey, before you can become a client of mine, we had this little bargain that I would like to run past you. And one part of the bargain is that I owe an awful lot of things to you because you've decided to become a client of mine. And the other part of it is, because you've become a client of mine, you owe me some things. And one of the things that you owe me is to refer to me 2 people of comparable quality to yourself. And the reason is...
Don't minimize. Say that again, because I think you're like Mike saying, oh yeah, by the way, $600 million came from that little idea.
2 people of comparable quality to yourself. And
because he's raising them to a height of acknowledgement and special. They're special to him. They're not the norm. His clients are a special elite breed, right?
They are special because they've been referred by other clients of mine.
Similar to them.
Yeah, similar to them, of comparable quality to them.
So I
require you that you do this before you join the practice. And when I first said that, I thought, oh, it's a bit scary. I'll probably get 50%, and that's pretty good. And in actual fact, the common response is, can I only refer you 2 people? Which I thought was an interesting response. It's not.
Now, why do you think you think they responded that way because they don't know the rules, and if you tell them these are the rules and you lead them, they say, hey, that must be the way to do it.
Structured before they come. I try and destroy their concepts of what it means to be in my particular business.
Tell everybody how you do that.
Well, whenever you run a business, whenever we run a business, we tend to copy the other people that run the same sort of business.
Why?
Because this is just the way it is. We do it in law.
There's no reason for it, though, is there? Is there a rule that says, is there a law that if you deviate one iota, you're going to be fined $5 trillion Australian dollars and sent to Tasmania for a week? I mean, I'm just asking.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. But we act as if there is a law like that in Australia. So we act as if we have to run our business exactly the same as everybody else has run their business. But we don't, and nothing happens awfully if we don't run our business in the same way. So I decided to destroy people's paradigms by changing my way of business. And one of the things that I did was I locked my front door so that people couldn't get in. And that makes it a little different. Does it make a difference? Yeah.
Do they have to ring a buzzer?
You've got to ring the bell. And there's a little sign on the door that says, thank you for calling, we're inside, but we can't do much unless you've been referred by someone who's already a client of ours. So if you've been referred or if you're a client of ours, please ring the bell. Otherwise, if you have a major problem, we'll try and find somebody who will help you, but we won't help you. I'm a dentist.
He's a brain surgeon.
Yeah, okay, a brain surgeon. I work on people's brains, yeah, and emotions. If you hold yourself out to be exclusive, people tend to want to get it. It's really weird, isn't it?
Continue.
No, this is snobbery, but that's part of it.
I believe the vast majority of the people in this room don't revere themselves. You don't hold yourself to a high enough standard of appreciation, valuation, and acknowledgement for what you do and the value, the benefit, and the worth it has to the customer you're rendering. If it really is worthless, you should probably evaluate seriously going into a different business. If it has worth, if it has value, if it has benefit, you should think how you can enhance it and make it proprietary, but respect yourself. Okay, put it back on.
I think you've made the point I want.
Thank you.
But no, you have, but it's brilliant. But the point is, let me add on it, and you can stand, and you can be a vivid illustration. I submit to you that if you don't revere yourself, nobody will. If you don't hold yourself to a higher standard, how can you be frustrated? How in the world can you possibly have the audacity or the right to be frustrated because your customer doesn't appreciate and respect and understand you if you don't hold yourself to a higher standard? Don't you think, Patty?
Absolutely.
But when you do and you don't do it, you can't. You got to do it with finesse, and you got to do it with education. You got to do it nurturously, and you got to do it very deftly. But when you do, they can't respect you if you don't give them a basis for that, can they?
No. If we don't love ourselves, it's hard for other people to love us.
And respect.
Yeah, or anything almost.
And our time and our ability.
Yeah.
And the result.
You position yourself almost wherever you want.
Okay.
You know that very well.
I've read about it somewhere.
Is that okay?
That was great. Thank you, Jeff.
Jay, that is just an incredible tape. I can understand why so many people have been impacted by that.
I'm very fortunate that I was able, through the interviewing process and the trust process, to get him to summarize in such a short, clear manner, Marty, the base essence of what has transformed his whole life, his business, his income, his posture, his positioning, his self worth and his self-assurance. He went from a dentist who was very, very unhappy to one of the happiest, most exhilarated men I've ever met in my life. And this basically embodies the whole philosophy in all of about 8 or so minutes.
Wow, that is a terrific interview. You use the word transactional philosophy. Can you explain that?
I think so. I look at your business and probably personal life as either theory or transaction. Action doesn't necessarily result in transaction. I think action is sometimes a frittered utilization of energy, because you can take a lot of actions that don't get you anywhere. I look at things trying to evolve to transactions that to me, a transaction produces a result.
Okay, so the trans part of the action there is when you connect up with something else.
Yeah, a lot of people get excited and they spend enormous amounts of time and effort preparing, contemplating. Years ago, I did a really expansive training program for people who wanted to learn how to do what I do. And I was fascinated and surprised by a number of people who spent an enormous amount of time getting their business cards ready and getting their letterhead and worrying about organizing their office instead of going out and getting clients. And then when they got clients, setting up programming. When they set up programming, implementing the programming. And when the programming works, improving the programming. And when the programming didn't work, replacing it with programming that did and bringing things into process. And I think transaction, at least to me, I may be defining or explaining or interpreting it or applying it not 100% correctly, but transaction to me means when you put events into productive action that produces a result as opposed to just dissipating and expending energy on activities that don't bring you anywhere.
Mm.
If you talk about real estate agents, which I learned it from them, they don't deal in what they deal in how many transactions occur, how many people buy or sell a piece of property. Not listings, but how many people bought a piece of property from you? How many people sold a piece of property from you? How many transactions did you close? And I think that's a good metaphoric illustration for all of us, because I think we talked in one of our programs about the fact that I don't particularly care about time or energy expended. I'm not one of these people who believes if you work 18 hours a day, you're going to succeed dramatically better. I have a lot of people who find it contemptuous that I sometimes work an hour a day. But the hour I work is extraordinarily concentrated, and it is leveraged to the highest level. It's the right hour. I'm getting the maximum, the optimal result from the time, the effort, and the forces and the resources I bring to bear. And everyone must recultivate or redefine their whole strategy on life to do the same.
Can you give any synonyms for the word transaction? Just broaden that a little bit. This is an incredible
idea. Let's see. By transaction, to me at least, I am referring to the process you use of getting productive and profitable programming into action in your life. By that I mean bringing ideas off the paper or out of your mind into application and then into viable reality, and I think it differs for different people, but I just mean all the time you think about things and all the time you contemplate things is useless. The only thing that the society and the world values, respects, and pays you for are results. When you realize that the world is not cold and heartless, it's extraordinarily equitable. It doesn't care whether you spend an hour. It doesn't care whether you spend a lifetime. It doesn't care whether you're the most brilliant person in the world or whether you've got an IQ of 62. All the world cares about is what results do you produce? How do you perform? And I think that's the most wonderful opportunity we all have, because I mean, there's no political, there's no educational, there's no capital limits. It's just what do you do with your time and your opportunity?
Hmm. That's an incredible bit of philosophy. That kind of makes the person hone down to doing what pays.
Well, I mean, I've learned that you don't get paid in life for enthusiasm. You don't get paid in life for intellect. You don't get paid in life for education. You get paid in life only for the results you produce. And if you look at it, all of us in life are on a commission, whether we realize it or not. We get paid in proportion to the results we produce. If you're a salaried person, you don't get raises, you don't get promotions if you don't perform exceptionally higher than the level that is normality for that situation. If you are a business owner, if you perform at or below average, you are paid at or below average, aren't you? If
mm-hmm.
the results you produce for others are no better than the results your competitors produce, you probably don't produce any better, and oftentimes you produce a lesser income for yourself and a lesser success rate. Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense.
A whole different way of looking at it, but to me, it's the most maybe not immaculate, but the most elegantly efficient way of looking at your life as a paying proposition.
Okay. All right. Well, let's shift gears a little.
Sure.
Talk about some headline tests.
Okay. Well, as you know, from previous sessions we've done together, the headline or its equivalent in marketing, in advertising, in selling, in commercials is the ad for the ad. It can be as much as 80 or 90% of the effectiveness, and Marty, it can impact the outcome by as much as 21 times. That means that by changing your headline, by identifying and incorporating a more powerful, a more specific, a more results-denominated results to the in context of results that will accrue to the customer, not results for you, the advertiser, a results-denominated headline, you, the advertiser, or you, the marketer, could improve the yield, the result, the return, the performance of that ad, of that sales letter, of that commercial, of that sales presentation, or script, or telephone script by as much as 2,100%. When you have that kind of leverage available to you in a world and in a business arena where there is virtually no other leverage, you've got to adhere, you've got to revere, you've got to respect, you've got to understand, and you've got to keenly be committed to testing and understanding all the nuances that that headlines can produce for you. So I'd like to share with you a little simple experiment that somebody else years ago in advertising did, because it'll show people the profound difference. First of all, they said headlines can make that big of a difference. And I told you what it is. Headlines aren't limited to print ads. As I said, you can use them in sales letters, commercials, sales presentations, anywhere else you need to grab your prospect's attention. So what I'll do is I'll read to you 10 different headline tests that were used in real advertising. Then I'll share with you the differential so you can get an idea of what that might have meant if you were spending $10,000 on an ad, if you were spending $10,000 or $20,000 on a mailing, if you were spending $5,000 a month dispatching a salesperson in the field or having telephone salespeople on the phone talking to people or in your store or in your facility, and they used the right or the wrong headline or opening to show you what the impact could be on your bottom line. This is from a display ad, so you're going to have to modify and you have to be this extrapolator and say, well, what's the implication to me if I did it in an electronic commercial on the radio? What's the implication if I did it in a direct mail letter? Okay. Headline A was the following: push button shave cream. Headline B: moisturized shave cream. Okay.
What was the difference there?
Headline A that said push button shave cream pulled 200% more results than headline B. 200%. That's twice the number of customers, twice the number of sales, twice the amount of profit from the same fixed expense.
And what was the difference there in the thinking of the customer?
I think the difference, Marty, was the fact that one talked about an ease of usage. The other just talked about moist, but didn't. It was one was feature. Remember we talked on one of our programs about feature and benefit? The feature is something most customers don't appreciate unless you transcend it or connect it to the benefit or the result it means to them.
Okay.
The first one is a result. Push button shave cream. It's easy. Turnkey. It's not messy. The other is moisturized shave cream. What does that mean to me? What's the relevancy?
And it was twice as effective.
Twice as effective.
Okay.
The next one, headline A, all leather handbags for only $28, parentheses. The last time we ran this ad, we sold out in 48 hours. The next one, this is the ad we had to cancel 3 months ago because we sold them so fast.
I'm trying to guess here before you say what happened.
You want me to tell you?
Yeah, please.
Headline B, this is the ad we had to cancel 3 months ago because we sold them out so fast, outpulled headline A by 300%.
Why?
This one, I honestly, this is one of the most wonderful things about headline tests. Sometimes there's a nuance that I don't know. I don't know exactly, no, Marty. I know that the second one, this is the ad we had to cancel 3 months ago because we sold them out so fast, has more it has more drama to it than A, but I'm not sure it has that much more. But the point I'm making is some of the greatest advertising masters in the world don't know which headline works best, because they always, when a great copywriter or a great sales professional crafts an ad or a sales letter or a mailing program,
mm-hmm.
they will test two or three different ad headlines or headline openings in their test. They'll use the same body copy with in two or three different tests because they don't even know. Experts don't even know. If experts don't even know, you can't begin to know. And when you're talking about variance or leverage or an inverse leverage that could easily be 200 or 300% or 2100%, you have to test, because you're leaving two or three times the profits, the sales, the return, the leads on the table if you do it wrong. Did I continue?
Yes, please.
Headline three. The first one is a 10-line test three. First headline, how to get your cooking bragged about. The second one, how to make your food taste better. What do you think pulled that?
I was afraid you were going to ask.
How to get your food bragged about. Because I think people want to be respected and admired by other people. They want to look, they want to not, remember we did a session where I said no one wants to be average?
Yeah. What kind of percentage difference?
42% better. But look at what that could mean if you're in any kind of business. We're getting new, let's say you were a grocer. Or let's say you were a cooking utensil retailers. And let's say that your goal was to get as many new customers, because you knew every time you got one new customer, he or she would buy from you 20 times a year forever. What would it be worth to get 42% more people to come in the first time over a lifetime?
People,
incalculable, Marty.
Yeah, people listening, just apply this a little bit. They easily will pay for the price of several subscriptions.
Yeah, for several lifetimes for several people.
Yeah.
But the point I'm making is I will keep doing this because I don't want to just pass over this, is two things. Number one, you have to test. Number two, even the experts don't know what the differences are. Number three, usually, but not always, specificity will outpull generalities. And what I think we'll do is when I'm done with this, I'll go back, because we started one time doing headline points, and I think I'll go back to it in this session and do a couple more, because I think it's a very powerful illustration.
Okay, go ahead.
What was I? I was on three?
Yes.
Number four. This is the fourth test. The first headline is a question. Quote, my insurance company, New England Life, of course. Why? Test B. The far-sighted man from New England Life could show you how you could get 30 years of life insurance and then get back all the money you put in.
I'm going to quit guessing.
I would have guessed number B.
Yeah.
However, and this is me, and I'm pretty knowledgeable, number A outpulled B by 200%. This was a lead gen.
No kidding.
Why? I don't know. Point is, don't presume. See, the trick in the – remember I said and it was in one of our previous – I don't know which one, because we've done so many now. One of our previous programs, I told you that you don't have the right to prejudge for your marketplace. You don't have the right to make a decision based on conjecture. You have the obligation and the responsibility and the opportunity to let your market tell you. And if you ask the market – they will always tell you the right decision, the right approach, the right premise, the right pricing. And that's the most wonderful. You don't have to worry about it. You just have to ask them in test form. Experts don't know, Marty. If experts don't know, people who are striving to become more expert couldn't begin to know. So all they have to do, rather than be frustrated and make a bad decision, is ask their market. Doing a test is inexpensive, and it can be so conclusive. You can do tests so many different ways. You can do them through little postcards, 500 one way, 500 the other. You can do them through running split-run tests. A lot of publications let you run two different ads and every other copy they print in a newspaper or a magazine. You can try calling on the phone 50 people with one opening premise and 50 people with another. You can have your salespeople dispatched trying 20 different, 20 people one approach and 20 people another. You can have one salesperson try one approach and one try another. You can try on telephone calls the same way. It may not be absolutely definitive, but it will be indicative, and that indicative information will give you a higher probability of using the right headline or opening in any program you put a lot of effort or money or importance behind. Let me do some more.
Please.
Okay. This is copy test or headline test 5. The first headline is the gift that comes 12 times a year. The second one, how to do your Christmas shopping in 5 minutes. Which one do you think pulled more?
I'm not hitting real well. Let's go with B.
B absolutely is the winner. It pulled 90% more revenue. Now think about this, Marty. If you send a letter, let's say you send 1,000 letters. The wrong letter produces $1,000. The right letter produces $1,900. Look at what you, that's only on the first transaction. If you're doing any kind of business where you have repeat, you got 90% more customers out of that transaction just by changing the premise, changing the opening.
Is it hard to keep this open mind and learning attitude?
I think it shouldn't be when you realize. See, I've always, rather than trying to teach what to do, I've always tried to give you a different premise or give people. I did a lot of work with Anthony Robbins a while back, and what I learned from him was pretty interesting. What I learned was simply this. People do more to get pleasure and avoid pain. And if I say to you, you're going to look back on your life, Marty, in regret and say that everything I did I could have done, I could have gotten 5 times the short term and probably 12 or 15 times the long term benefit out of by doing it differently, and differently would have been easier and less risky and more fun, but I didn't choose to do that, that's pretty pathetic, isn't it? That's how I would look at it if I were the listener.
Okay.
I would never allow myself. Every day I'd say, am I doing this the smartest way, the most optimal way? Am I getting the most yield for the least risk, for the least time? Am I getting the most residual value? If I'm not, what questions do I have to ask the market? Keep in mind, the quality of your life is in direct proportion, and the success of your life or your business is in direct proportion to the quality of the questions you ask yourself and others, and the quality and the clarity, and also the quality and the clarity of the questions you ask yourself and others, and the quality and the clarity of the answers you get back.
Questions.
And testing is nothing more than questioning your marketplace, throwing your suppositions to them, because you don't have no individual, even the brightest people, I can tell you, the smartest people, people who make $1 million a year writing headlines, don't know the answer. That's why they test. Reader's Digest for years would test headlines in little postcards before they would ever put them on a 10 million run of a magazine, because they knew the difference between one headline and a different could make a difference in selling an extra 500,000 copies of newsstand. The National Enquirer has a full-time headline writer who writes the teaser on the outside of the issue.
Okay.
That man or woman is paid like $200,000 a year just for writing headlines.
Is that right?
And why do you think they do that? You think that they're promiscuous and they're wasteful and they're indulgent? Or you think that they know something that most people listening to this tape don't know? Should we do another one?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, headline test 6. Question A. What is buffered aspirin? Headline B. How to stop a headache without upsetting your stomach?
B.
B was the winner by 50%. 50% doesn't sound like a lot, but again, if you're getting customers who are going to buy many times a year forever, what is it worth to you over forever to get 50% more new people in the door, figuratively or literally speaking?
Basically, you're getting that additional 50% for no added outlay.
Or you could say it differently. Some of these ads that pull 3 times better than the other, the headlines,
mm-hmm.
You could actually run 1/3 the size ad and pull the same yield that you're currently getting for the same investment. There's a lot of ways of looking at it.
Hmm.
I had a really interesting, by the way, there's another nuance that I'll share now. When you run ads, particularly display ads, if you decide you want to run a full-page ad, but all you really have to put in there is a quarter page's worth of copy, all you have done is increase the cost per sale or per customer or per lead by 4 times. And in other words, all you're doing is indulging your ego if you take an ad that should only be a quarter page in size and blow it up to a full page, and you think you're really smart because you're getting attention. Well, you're really dumb, because what you're doing is you're paying four times the cost. You'd be much better off running four quarter-page ads in the publication with different headlines and different premises. You'd get a lot more bang for your buck than you would taking a quarter page's worth of ad and putting it in a full page worth of space. Does that make sense?
Makes sense.
These are pretty interesting and simple, and when I utter them, they're probably, most of them are pretty evident, aren't they?
Well, once you explain it, it kind of falls out, but it's
let's,
brand
let's
new.
Let's do another one.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, this is copy test or headline test 7. First headline, dry up hay fever. The next one was just hay fever.
Okay, I don't know if this will be a trick one or not. Dry up hay fever.
That's true. It outpulled the other by 27%.
Hmm.
I think it's because it showed a transaction that applied to a specific response. Hay fever, just ask anybody if you suffered.
Mm-hmm.
This one promised a relief, a result, transaction. Remember we talked about that?
Right, right.
Benefit?
Right. Jay, let me ask you, how important are headlines?
I would say this, Marty. Headline is probably, in its all of its equivalents, including its application to sales presentation, it's up to 80 or 90% of the success factor of what you're doing, because the headline embodies the result, the promise, the payoff, the transactional benefit the customer gets. And remember, a headline is not just a headline in its literal sense. It's not just the big, bold phrase that appears in the beginning of an ad. It's also the opening phrase you utter in a commercial. It's the opening premise you state when you're encountering a sales prospect live on the phone in your facilities. If you don't understand it, you're leaving potentially 21 times the business, the success, the customers, the flow of new customers, the residual value on the table, and it translates everywhere. And if you understand it in one medium, it translates and is universally applicable. I would say of all the areas people should work on to learn in tactical or technique-based marketing, headlining or its equivalent, or opening premises, or positioning and denominating the result and the benefit to the customers should be all important.
Okay, how do you learn that? What are the rules?
Well, there's a lot of rules. Remember, I think I started by sharing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or so headlines on one of the edges. I think what I'd like to do in reverence to and acknowledgement of the importance is maybe do a real quick litany of a bunch of different factors. I've got in front of me a collection from my own files of great headlines and some explanatory statements. I could go through a very quick, probably 15 or 20 minute overview of them, and I think it'd be very valuable for the people.
It sounds like this is the fulcrum of fulcrums.
It really is. It changes your whole strategic understanding of the way to really get leverage on your efforts in any marketing context you might do. In any marketing action, whether it be a letter, whether it be an advertisement, whether it be a telephone call, whether it be a postcard, whether it be a sign that you put on at a display at a trade show, in front of your store, on a truck, on a billboard, these techniques are universally applicable, and they're so significant and profound and key leverage factors that failure to understand them is denying yourself or limiting or restricting the level of success your company could reap.
Okay, let's do more on side two of The Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. Okay, give it to me. I can take it straight here.
Well, this might be repetitive, but it's worth it because I can't remember where I stopped last time, and I'm going to go through about 100 quick examples.
Ooh, all right, go ahead.
It'll be very fast. Number one, demonstrate the claim by showing a prime example. The example given is this headline. At 60 miles an hour, the loudest noise in the Rolls-Royce is the electric clock. Dramatize the claim or its result. Example given, they laughed when I sat down at the piano, --, but when I started to play, --. State the claim as a paradox, how a bald-headed barber saved my hair. Remove limitations from the claims, shrinks hemorrhoids without surgery. Associate the claim with values or people with whom the prospect wishes to be identified. 9 of our 10 decorators use one-to-weave carpets for long life at low cost. Show how much work in detail the claim does. relieves congestion in all seven nasal passages instantly. Offer information about how to accomplish the claim. Here's what you do to get rid of pimples fast. Tie authority to the claim. Here's what doctors do when they feel rotten. Show before and after the claim. Before Wheezo, hay fever medication made you drowsy. With Wheezo, you can have relief and be alert. Stress the newness of the claim. Announcing, guided missile spark plugs. Stress the exclusivity of the claim. Ours alone, Persian Lamb Originals, $289.75. Turn the claim into a challenge for the reader. Does she or doesn't she? Only her hairdresser knows for sure. Keep in mind, understand those listening to this, pick up on the explanation. The example given is only to show you demonstration.
Okay.
State the claim as a case history quotation. Would you believe it? I have a cold. Condense the claim. Interchange your product and the product it replaces. Pour yourself a new engine.
Mm-hmm.
Symbolize the claim. Replace the direct statement or measurement of the claim with a parallel reality. Starting July 5th, the Atlantic Ocean becomes only one-fifth as wide. Surprise the reader into realizing that former limitations have now been overcome. See what happens when you crush our executive luggage. Nothing. Address the people who can't buy your product. If you've already taken your vacation, don't read this. It will break your heart. Dramatize how hard it was to produce the claim. It took 24 years and genetic engineering to make this product possible. Accuse the claim of being too good. It should be immoral to make money this easily. Challenge the prospect's present limiting beliefs. You are twice as smart as you think. Connect the mechanism to the claim in the headline. Floats fat right out of your body. Offer information in the ad itself. What everybody ought to know about the stock and bond business. Turn the claim or the need into a case history. Aunt Mary, comma, who never married, .. Give a name to the problem or need. When you're weary with daytime fatigue, take Alka-Seltzer. Warn the reader about possible pitfalls if he doesn't use your product. Don't invest 1 cent of your hard-earned money until you check this guide. Emphasize the claim by its phraseology. Break it down into 2 sentences or repeat all or part of it. A man you can lean on, that's whatever. Or nobody but nobody teaches like blank. Show how easy the claim is to accomplish by imposing a universally overcome limitation. If you can count to 11, you can increase your speed and skill at numbers. State the difference in the headline. The difference in premium gasoline is in the additives. Now, I'll give you some more, but do you understand that all of these could easily be the opening line of a letter? All of these could be modified into the opening premise you talk about when you engage somebody in person or on the phone?
Yeah, I understand that, and that opening premise is going to determine the range of transactions that occur later on.
Well, if I was trying to sell you a washing machine, I said, Marty, or Mrs. Smith, let me tell you about one machine that will produce 6 times wider washes. You'd probably get your attention, wouldn't it?
Yes.
If you came in and you're trying to lose weight, and I said, let me tell you about a system we developed that melts fat away, that melts away ugly fat fast and easy. If I said, when you came in to look at my Rolls Royce, let me tell you about how quiet it is. First of all, at 60 miles an hour, the loudest noise you're going to hear is the electric clock. I'm just trying to show you can use it in personal dialogue, too.
Mm-hmm.
If you're coming in to start to learn how to play the piano or you want to buy a piano but you don't know, and I say, look, everyone will laugh when you first have the piano installed because they won't even know that I've already worked with you for 3 sessions. But when you sit down and start to play, they'll all drop their jaws. You see, all this translates.
Mm-hmm.
So let me read some more because I think that people need this. And I'll just go through a bunch of them real quick. Okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Number 1, the secret of making people like you. Number two, a little mistake that cost a farmer $3,000 a year. These are successful headlines from the past that you can use as matrix or models or bases to build your own headlines or their equivalents. Advice to wives whose husbands don't save money by a wife. The child who won the hearts of all. Are you ever tongue-tied at a party? How a new discovery made a plain girl beautiful. How to win friends and influence people. The last 2 hours are the longest, and those are the 2 hours you save. Who else wants a screen star figure? Do you make these mistakes in English? Why some foods explode in your stomach. Hands that look lovelier in 24 hours or your money back. You can laugh at money worries if you follow this simple plan. Why some people almost always make money in the stock market. There's some overlap in this, I think, on the other headlines I just read you, so bear with me. When doctors feel rotten, this is what they do. It seems almost incredible that you can offer these original signed etchings for only $5 a piece. Five familiar skin troubles. Which do you want to overcome? Which of these $2.50 to $5 bestsellers do you want for only $1 each? Who ever heard of a woman losing weight and enjoying three delicious meals at the same time? How I improve my memory in one evening. Discover the fortune that lies hidden in your salary. Doctors prove 2 out of 3 women can have more beautiful skin in 14 days. How I made a fortune with a fool idea. Now, do you see all these have lateral application, Marty?
Mm-hmm.
Thousands have this priceless gift but never discover it. Anybody saying that in the form of an opening line in a radio commercial, and you have a lot of familiarity with radio commercials, would get people's attention, wouldn't it?
Surely.
Whose fault when your children disobey? How a fool stunt made me a star salesman. Any of these you can modify and use in any application in your life, in your business, in your letters, in your opening, and you must test them. These are all winners. Have you any of these symptoms of nervous exhaustion? Guaranteed to go through ice, mud, or snow, or we pay the tow. Have you a worry stock? How a new kind of clay improved my complexion in 30 minutes. 161 new ways to a man's heart in this fascinating book for cooks. Profits that lie hidden in your farm. Is the life of a child worth a dollar to you? Everywhere, women are raving about this amazing new shampoo. Do you do any of these 10 embarrassing things? 6 types of investors. Which group are you in? How to take out stains, use blank, and follow these directions. Today, you can add $10,000 to your estate for the price of a new hat. Does your child ever embarrass you? And I can go on and on because I've got hundreds here. But
okay.
You get the idea?
Yeah, what you're saying is that a lot of the advertising, maybe most of it that you hear, see, or encounter, misses the mark. I mean,
most of them really don't have a headline. If they do have a headline, the headlines fail miserably to address and articulate the biggest result or question or issue most people are dealing with, or to provocatively get their attention on some basis that offers some information that will provide a benefit that they have always or would always or never thought of but would like to get an advantage on. All headlines can be translated into the opening sentences or paragraphs of a letter, or the opening sentences or paragraphs that the salesman or woman poses, asks, states when they either engage somebody or when somebody calls them. And when you understand that, it is the most universally powerful leverage factor any business owner has in anything they do, communicationally speaking.
Wow, that not only is a remedial for people already in business, for someone starting out, that's going to save them tons of time and make them a lot of money and bring them a lot of reward.
So, incalculably so, right.
Wow. Okay, you have the saying that you would not trust someone with your advertising that can't sell one-on-one.
Well, yes. I mean, I ask questions to people when they use agencies. Why would you entrust somebody with the job of selling to the masses that they've never, ever sold one-on-one. Most people who purport themselves to be advertising agencies or copywriters have never sold one-on-one. If they can't sell one-on-one, they can't sell en masse because all the media is being listened to, received, or read one person at a time. So you've got to write it the same way. It's not written to the masses, and most of the copy that's written to the masses is ineffectual. If you understand that, you will never, ever, ever allow any man or woman to create copy for letters, for ads, for commercials, unless he or she first comes into your facility and can demonstrate to you their ability to sell your product or service one-on-one. That means they either get behind the counter, get on the telephone, go out in the field, knock on doors, do something. People unwilling or uninterested in doing that show me that they are disrespecting and disacknowledging the most critical factor of importance in trying to connect with you and your business, connect your business to your customer or prospect.
Do you have any illustrations of this?
Well, sure. I mean, it's basically, if you look at advertising, is nothing more than a commissioned sales force for you. If you send out 10,000 letters, it's 10,000 salesmen or women out there working for you. If you run an ad in a newspaper, and the newspaper is read by 500,000 people, you're sending out 500,000 salespeople knocking on somebody's door, coming into their home or their office. If they don't make the right proposition, if they don't make the right sales overture, if they don't connect and they don't focus externally on the results, the needs, the problems, the issues, the hopes, the dreams, the fears, the worries, the opportunities for that individual reader, they have lost you. Whoever's created that ad erroneously for you has lost you such an opportunity and such an advantage that it's grievous, and it may never, ever be repeated because certain people will never read again. Certain people you'll never connect with.
Mm-hmm.
It's an opportunity lost forever. And when you look at it that way, you have to revere it. But, I mean, think about it. Most people writing ads are creative. They have no idea what embodies salesmanship. Salesmanship or saleswomanship is a very simple process, but it's a process of getting people's attention, compelling them with a self-serving interest, getting them to action, getting them to desire the product, and taking them to action. But if you don't do that, if I can't sell your product one-on-one, why in the world would you hope that I could sell it in mass? Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You're promiscuous with your biggest opportunity. If I said to you, okay, I'm going to deploy 10,000 ineffectual salesmen and women in the field who can't sell anything, they're going to knock on the door, and when you open the door, they're just going to sit there looking dumb because mm-hmm. they don't know what to say or they don't say the right thing, and not only are they not going to sell, but they're going to do a disservice to you. Would you want to employ that kind of a sales force? That's what 10,000 letters are. That's what an ad on a radio listened to by 10,000 drivers are. That's what an ad in the paper read by 500,000 individuals is, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Have you in your consultation or maybe personally ever confronted someone in this manner? Do you recall any incidents?
Sure. I mean, whenever I have a client and they want to hire someone to write an ad for them, I'll ask the ad writer to demonstrate that he or she can first sell the product. I'll ask them if they want to basically come for a day at our expense and work in our facility. I'll ask them if they want to go around with the salespeople. If they say no, it shows me they're not committed enough to learn empathically the point, or at least they want to call and talk to a bunch of customers. If they just want to sit down in their cleverness and write the ad from scratch without even trying to get in the mind and the heart and the soul of the individual customer or salesperson, I don't think they really are committed to trying to do me or my client the noblest service. Do you think about it?
Good sense makes the good rationale. You mind if I switch gears a little?
Artie, I'm putty in your hand.
you are the probably the world's best at finding hidden wealth. How about some strategies of overlooked assets?
Sure. I'll give you a philosophy on it a little bit. First of all, you have to take the philosophy that almost every human being in business or outside has what I'll call secret wealth or hidden wealth. They have opportunities and assets in their life and their job and their skill and their customer base and what they do that they don't begin to harvest anywhere close to the true potential and pay out and profit from. If you decide that you're going to do that and you decide that you're going to start optimizing your life, you've got to start looking at it in a much more comprehensive way. The first thing you've got to do is define what wealth is. Wealth can be real money or tangible or intangible assets that can lead to real money on a one-shot or residual basis. It can be relationships that you have invested a lifetime in that trust you and have access to buying influences that you can use for things you currently offer or for things other people offer, but that would be very valuable if connected. For example, you may have a past relationship and a past embodiment of your life where you you worked in an area where you have contacts with all kinds of buyers of a certain kind of product. Maybe today in your life you don't sell that product, but you've invested 5 or 10 years of your life working for a company that invested maybe 50 years developing relationships with key buyers who liked you and respected you. And when you went to a new business, you may have abandoned that. But those relationships could be invaluable to somebody having a product or service those buyers would want who doesn't have the sales force or the effort to go from scratch, knocking on doors, building credibility, getting all the way up. One little phone call you could make could get somebody access, and that access could open up a client or a buying source or a customer or distributive opportunity that most companies would never in their life have access to. You could make that available and in the process charge a fee or charge a percentage or get so much a transaction and make more money from reclaiming an old asset you disregarded than you can maybe from your own business. Does that make sense?
Makes sense.
In your life, you may have skill sets. I talked about processes on one of our calls, but you may have, in the course of any business, most businesses have expertise they don't recognize. Some aspect of the way you conduct your business, you operate more effectively, more profitably, more productively than other people in your generic field and also than other people who do things similar or relative or related to you. By that, it may be the way you operate inventory. Maybe it's the way you produce. Maybe it's the way you ship. Maybe it's the way you hire and get performance out of people. Maybe it's the way you sell. Maybe it's the way you advertise. Maybe it's your average transaction per customer. When you realize that there's all kinds of different processes that embody the way you transact and operate your business, and any one of which can be segregated, identified, and valued, you could teach all kinds of methods to other people of how you do things better than they do, and people would pay a fee, a usage, a percentage of the increase or the savings for doing that. We've done it all along. Years and years, I made millions of dollars a year by teaching better ways to get more sales per customer, more customers per transaction. I've had clients I've worked with sell their processes or lease their processes to other people. One person that I know leased a process for renewing customers to newsletters, and he made millions of dollars by leasing the same process over and over. Another person I knew was in the car wash business. I may have talked about it. He had a process that got customers to buy twice as many, on average, twice as many customers bought hot wax and the detail package, which was the real profit, as average. He was able to sell the technique on a monthly usage basis to 1,000 other car washes and made more money from the licensing than he did from the actual operation of the car wash. I think I told a story in one of our other sessions of the dry cleaner who was very successful, and he took his processes for advertising and direct mail and customer conservation, and he leased those for $50 a month to 1,000 or 2,000 other dry cleaners and made millions of dollars. I have a client who is a lumber mill, and I told you he developed a process for kiln drying lumber that produced many times greater consistency of lumber, and kiln drying has an impact on the quality of lumber and the wastage. It reduced wastage by half. It increased the quality by about 20%. It reduced the energy consumption by about 30%. And he was able to sell that for $1 million so far, and he keeps making another couple $100,000 licensing the techniques. There's so many things you do that makes more money, that saves money, that makes delivery easier, that's more effective, more productive, more tax advantageous, more effective, efficient, that gets average productivity improved, that gets capital investment lower, that gets cost of inventory down, that gets utility per employees up. If you start questioning and examining what you do more effectively and with more expertise than your existing competitors, you can find all kinds of avenues of secret wealth that other people pay through the nose for. Does that make sense?
Makes
relationships
sense.
You have. You can have all kinds of goodwill with current and old customers that you can use to a far higher level by introducing, recommending, endorsing, offering them all kinds of kindred or complementary or progressive products or services that other people produce or sell that you don't, but that are natural adjuncts or next stage improvements on what you do, and by using your goodwill, the enormous effort and investment you have sunk in your business and in your relationship with your customers over all these years, and by using that as a basis to use the goodwill to introduce them with authority to other products or service, you can make more money selling them other people's products or services than you ever and you even make on your own business. And it shouldn't matter because you're in business to optimize profit ethically.
Okay, okay.
Does that give you some ideas?
Yeah, it does. Is there a way to analyze this so that you can find out where this hidden wealth is?
Well, I try to get people to create what I'll call a secret wealth inventory, and it's a process. And and I'll give you a short course. It takes probably 6 hours to go through the process in detail, but a short course overview of it is pretty simple. Number one, you got to recognize that everyone has secret wealth, and most people have multiple secret wealth veins in their lives and their history and their relationship and their skill sets and their abilities and their contacts and their customers and their processes. So you got to recognize that you really have it. You got to believe that you have every entitlement to get paid handsomely and continuously for everything you've already done and all the wealth you've already created but not harvested yet. It's almost like you've taken carbon and you've turned it into diamonds, but you've never harvested it, refined it, or figured out what to do with it and how to translate it into commerce for yourself. So this is the recognition, the mining, and the harvesting of the selling or the converting of it from raw, unrecognized asset to transactional bottom line profit.
Would you tell your clients then to make a list of all of this?
I do, and it covers a lot of things. First of all, what's the skills that you or your company are most proficient at? If you're a greater advertiser, if you're a greater marketer, if you're a greater operator, if there are people within your company who have incredibly great skill sets, identify all those because those are assets you can either use more effectively in your own business, you can license to others, or you can use to combine with other opportunities you can take advantage of.
Okay.
Same thing as knowledge. What do you have knowledge of that other people don't? And how can you use that knowledge most effectively? What relationships do you have that you're not maximizing? Distribution lines, vendors, customers, past relationships, colleagues, organizational associations who've got the capacity to be connected to either access you to other people who can help you or that you can help other people with. Either way, there can be profits realized. What are the assets you've got? Your customers, old advertisement, locations, equipment, skilled staff. A lot of times people will have skilled staff they don't fully utilize, or they'll have storage facilities they don't fully utilize, or they'll have distribution capacities they don't fully utilize, or they'll have customers they only sell one or two items to, but they have such great relationships with them, they could easily introduce them to five other people's products and make half the profit just by doing that because those five people don't have relationships and it's found money and it's a huge amount of profit that never would have been realized if you didn't let your resources be connected. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
I can go on and on, but those are the basic. If you just do that much, you've probably identified more secret wealth than 90% of the people you'll ever meet or deal with. It's also a mindset. It's a mindset that says that you've got to get leverage on everything you've ever done in the past, on everything you're doing, on everybody you've ever met, on every concept or technique or strategy you've ever used, on every piece of human capital you've ever invested in, either through an employee, through a relationship, through a professional association, through a past employer, through anything. You've got to realize there are no rules and you are unshackled in the way you operate except to the tune of the fact that you only are limited by what's legal. You can do anything else and it has no bearing on what your industry normally does. You can make more money from people you don't sell. You can make more money from licensing techniques that you use in a little application, but that could be applied to 25,000 other people. You can use your skill sets, your core competencies, all the different ways. I mean, it's just limitless, Marty.
Wow, it's just a matter of sitting down, doing a little analysis and thinking and writing.
And you got to look at everything you do as a paying proposition, and you got to look at it as a hard-nosed, bottom-line businessman or woman. And a hard-nosed business person is committed to getting the most they can out of everything they do, and you've got to be that way too. And everything you do is if you segregate every transaction in your business and your life as a paying proposition, whether it be payoff being more love, more happiness, you owe it to yourself to get everything you can out of everything you've got and everything you do.
Okay. Okay, Jay, I've been studying you and your work. Let me just bring up a stream of things and have you comment. All right?
Sure.
Okay, sequential marketing.
Well, I think the biggest area that I'm really renowned on is that my understanding that human nature today is more apprehensive, ambivalent, apathetic, skeptical, dubious-minded, and that most people give up prematurely. In any kind of high-ticket or intangible or multi-step selling or multi-influence selling where there's many decision-makers, a lot of the clinical work I've done and the studies and the tests and the research has proven to me definitively that the real true success comes to the men or women who understand sequential marketing. It's a call, letter that constantly advances the relationship, and that they understand a sequence of integrated communications that advance it and explain it and illustrate it and demonstrate it and their stability, that you are stable, that you are walking your talk, that you really are what you say you are, is critically important. What that means is you may start with a call and follow it up with a letter, and then follow it up with a call and follow it up with a letter at strategically timed intervals, and that you've got to make sure every one of those communiques is critically integrated and that they all contain an embodiment of valuable information or knowledge. You don't just basically use sales rhetoric because people throw that away. Every communication must share information and ideas and insights and must have an impact on people that they derive a profit from, whether it's an intellectual profit or a transactional profit. But a study was done recently, and I think it said that the average high-ticket sales, something like 80% of the sales went to the people who expended at least 5 to 8 integrated sequential follow-up efforts, that most people give up prematurely when people don't buy on the first or the second overture. I have found in some of the greatest relationships of my life emanated from me being willing to invest sequentially and strategically multiple communications. And I find that letter, call, letter, or meeting, letter, call, letter, meeting is the way. I used to be involved in a selling situation years ago, and I analyzed and I found that the key for that particular dynamic was it took 7. If I had 100 prospects in process, I had to do a series of 7 call, letter calls over about an 8-week period. And if I did that, I always would get 12% of the people in process to convert. I never knew which ones would convert at the right time. If I ever aberrated or tried to shorten it because I was in a hurry, it never would work. If I respected it and I made sure that every communication always transferred knowledge and ideas, always gave information they didn't know, always gave them an idea they could put into application, I was profited and benefited at a very high level.
Hmm.
Everyone should take heed of that. Don't give up prematurely. People are ambivalent. Everyone's trying to get at them and their wallet, and they don't trust people. They want to see how you'll perform long-term, whether over 3 or 4 communications you'll be as enthusiastic, as giving, as externally focused, as consistent. Most people disappear. Most people get angry. Most people show their true colors. If you really are congruent and you really are strategically committed, a lot of great things will happen.
I would guess some people who are successful, as you were, may not have analyzed what they're doing, the actual sequence.
A lot of people don't analyze what got them where they are, and so they can't really get leverage on themselves. I've spent an enormous amount of time stepping outside myself and having, I guess, an out-of-body, out-of-mind, out-of-concept experience where I spent a lot of time trying to codify, analyze, define, evaluate, examine, observe, and understand what made all the difference for me.
Okay, talk about lead generation.
Well, most people don't understand that lead generation is the most critical process in most selling situations, even low ticket, because a lot of people, first of all, have to be introduced to you, and then they take the next step. Lead generating is done many different ways. The first thing you'd have to do is find something of value to offer them to get them to either respond or present themselves or call or show up or come in. It can be a free sample. It can be a booklet. It can be a seminar. It can be a free consultation. It can be an evaluation. It can be an examination. It can be an observation. It can be a participation. It can be a bonus. It can be something that gets people to want. Usually it's a result, something that will show them a greater advantage or give them revelation.